If you would, turn to John chapter 11. We've been examining a series of lessons on basically courtroom dramas in the Bible that we've titled Faith on Trial. So as we've looked at people of faith from the Old Testament and the New Testament who have had to stand trial and give an answer for themselves and their convictions and their behavior and their teachings, we finally come to the ultimate example, the most faithful man ever and the most unjust trial in the history of the world. You couldn't find a more perfect person. And so for Jesus, the Son of God, the only flawless human being to be convicted and sentenced to death, that really we just don't have words in our language to describe the magnitude of this, the injustice of this particular occasion, of this trial, of this mockery of a trial. And so, how did it happen? And how does it continue to happen even to this day? That's what we'll be thinking about really over the next two lessons. The evening that Jesus was arrested, culminating in the following day when with his death on the cross, there were about six trials, depending on how you count them. And so basically three of them were before the Jews, the chief priests, and then three of them were before the Romans, Herod and Pilate. So we're going to kind of split that right in half. And tonight we're going to be looking at Jesus' trials when he was standing before his own people, the people of Israel, God's people who rejected him, of course, and were the first to turn against him and sentence him to death. And next week we will, Lord willing, well, it'll be 2 weeks from now, we'll, Lord willing, continue with the second half of this where Jesus stood trial before the Roman rulers of that area as well. Turn with me to John chapter 11 in your Bibles. John chapter 11. We're going to back up and get just a little bit of background. We might wonder, how did Jesus come to be arrested and on trial to begin with? What led up to that? Well, really, that starts at the beginning, doesn't it? All the way from his birth, remember, Herod tried to destroy him. And at various times during his ministry, when he was teaching and doing miracles, especially whenever he did anything on the Sabbath, it would aggravate people. The Jews who were close by, always watching, always critical, always offended, constantly tripping over the cornerstone. And so there were many occasions where they sought to kill Jesus, but this ultimate plot that ends up with him standing trial, really the groundwork for that starts in John 11, where Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead. And of course you could expect, right, a miracle of that magnitude right outside of Jerusalem would have a huge impact, and they recognize this. So look at we'll start in verse 45. Of John chapter 11. I've got a new Bible and my pages are kind of sticking together. So let me get over there. Many of the Jews, therefore, who had come with Mary and had seen what he did, believed in him, but some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. So the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered the council and said, "What are we to do? For this man performs many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation." So they're panicking because everybody is believing on Jesus. Well, I wonder why. Things like raising people from the dead has that effect on people. They think there must be something about this man that's special. This is, they're so blinded to that, that they never stop to question, maybe we should believe in him too. That's out of the question completely because they're so focused on themselves and their position of power, their authority, and they feel threatened by Jesus. And so they're wringing their hands and saying, what are we going to do? Now verse 49, one of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, said to them, "You know nothing at all. Nor do you understand that it's better for you that one man should die for the people, not that the whole nation should perish." I read an interesting thing that the Sadducees, which they were, this ruling class would have been part of, were sort of famous for being rude. And even here you can see his rudeness even to his fellow men, you know, he's like, "You guys are a bunch of numbskulls. Don't you see the answer's right in front of you? What are we going to do with Jesus? It only makes sense if one person threatens the stability of the nation for that one person to die for the people." And John says, as wicked and corrupt as he was the high priest, and he was actually speaking words of prophecy that he didn't fully appreciate the import of his own words. Verse 51 says, he did not say this of his own accord, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation. Not only for the nation only, but also to gather into one the children of God who are scattered abroad. So from that day on, they made plans to put him to death. So this is when they said, okay, now let's figure out how we are going to do this. There had been times when they really wanted to kill Jesus. There had been, you know, little flash mobs that decided to destroy him. But now the leaders have said, let's huddle together and let's come up with a plan. Now there's several challenges to killing Jesus. He's extremely popular. Wherever he goes, there's always crowds around him. So how are they going to just show up and arrest Jesus in front of all these, you know, all these followers of his and disciples? And then how are they going to carry out some kind of execution of this man that everybody considers a prophet? So challenge number one is we've got to somehow arrest him. And that problem solves itself for them when Judas shows up and says, hey, what will you give me to turn him over to you? Well, that's 30 pieces of silver well spent for them, because he's going to figure out where they can get Jesus when nobody's around. Of course, that's the key that he brings to the whole plan is he knows where Jesus goes at night. He knows where they can find him when there's nobody around. So that's Judas's contribution to this scheme. And then the next thing is, what are they going to charge him with? I mean, how are they going to justify killing this man? If they're going to do this as some official action where we're going to have him executed, we have to have some reason. So we need to have something to accuse him of. That is the purpose of these overnight trials that we're going to be looking at today. And then we need to have somebody execute him. And their plan for that is, we'll let the Romans do the dirty work. So that's next time when we see how they tried to twist the arms of the Roman rulers to do their dirty work for them and kill this man Jesus. So tonight, having already basically had Judas drop in their lap the answer to the problem of arresting Jesus, we're going to look at how did they come up with charges against him during the course of these overnight trials. And for that, skip over to John chapter 18. I'm not going to have anything on the screen during these first few points as we walk through it, and I'll have a few things there when we get to the application part of it. John 18, beginning verse 12, says, the band of soldiers and their captains and officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him. First, they led him to Annas, for he was father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was high priest that year. It was Caiaphas who had advised the Jews that it would be expedient that one man should die for the people. All right, a little bit of confusion here about these high priests. They were sort of, in a sense, two high priests. And the reason is, Annas was the official high priest. He had been high priest for a long time, or he had been, until he upset the Romans. Well, the Romans were over all this, you know. And they sort of let the Jews do their own thing as long as they behaved and didn't cause any trouble. They let them kind of run the show, or you know, of leading their own people. And the high priest was the highest official among the Jews. But Annas had upset the Romans, so they had demoted him. And they put other people in and instead of him. And so Caiaphas was now the actual high priest. But Annas is always there, and he was well respected among people. He carried a lot of clout. And so he is called the high priest as well. So both of these men are called high priest. And it was kind of like the ex officio high priest is Annas. But he still comes to the meetings. And then you've got Caiaphas. And so that's these two people. And it is interesting that it appears they go to Annas first. And that shows that they probably saw him as the true authority behind the scenes, the true power behind the throne. And so they bring Jesus to Annas. Now this is all in the middle of the night. I've read several different places that according to the Jews' own rules, it was illegal to have court in the middle of the night. You know, things are literally supposed to be done in the day, for obvious reasons, especially if you're trying someone of a capital offense. It isn't supposed to be some sort of secret, hidden away, court where, we tried him last night and convicted him and we're killing him today. But that's exactly what they're doing here. There's nothing about this that's legitimate, what they're doing. Now, also, picture the absurdity of what this setup is. You've got the high priest. all the way back to Aaron, the brother of Moses, the first high priest. The role of the high priest was to be anointed to be the representative of the people who entered into the most holy place, to offer sacrifice on behalf of the people and basically represent them in the presence of God. And this is the high priest who should have led the whole nation in embracing and worshiping Jesus as the long-awaited Messiah. And instead, you have the leader of God's people, the high priest, who's supposed to be the go-between, sort of, between God and man, who is instead interrogating and hatching a plot and carrying it out to kill the Son of God. So the irony is just, there's not words to really adequately describe the irony of this picture that we have before us of the Word become flesh, Jesus standing there being interrogated and questioned by the high priest, which is just so wrong on so many levels. It's also interesting that since the high priest was the one who offered the sacrifice to make atonement for the sins of the people, he's sort of unknowingly going along with this whole thing, and he doesn't realize the part that he's playing in this, of course, not any to any of his credit. John 18, now verse 19. The high priest then questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. And Jesus answered him, "I've spoken openly to the world. I've always taught in synagogues and in the temple where all Jews come together. I've said nothing in secret. Why do you ask me? Ask those who have heard me what I said to them. They know what I said." The whole thing, of course, is a mockery, and Jesus knows it. Here's the high priest, and his opening line of inquiry is, "So, tell me about what is it you teach?" You know, this is just silliness, because Jesus always teaches, and there's always a crowd of people around. He's taught in the temple. He's taught everywhere he goes. There's crowds of people, and the high priest could have come at any time if he wanted to hear what Jesus says. He would have been welcome to come and sit and listen and hear for himself. So number one, Jesus says, "I've been teaching in public all this time. There's no need to basically arrest me in the middle of the night and drag me in here to ask me what I teach, because you could find that out in the morning if you wanted to come and, you know, where I'll be teaching, if aside from this, crazy trial." And secondly, he says, there's thousands of people out there who have listened to me teach, and you could have asked any one of them if you wanted to know. It just shows the ridiculousness of all this. And they sense that, because the response is in verse 22, when he said these things, one of the officers standing by struck Jesus with his hand, saying, "Is that how you answer the high priest?" But Jesus answered him, "If what I said is wrong, bear witness about the wrong. But if what I said is right, why do you strike me?" Of course, Jesus' answer shows the ridiculousness of this whole thing, but the flaw is not in Jesus or his answer. It was in the priest and this trial and all that stuff, and his response really just shined a light on that, and that's why this man lashed out against him. Verse 24 says, Annas then sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. Now, from what I read as well, these two men lived in basically the same compound. There was a palace, the high priest's place, right there in Jerusalem, and their houses would have been, I don't know if they were like next door neighbors or part of the same building, but this is the courtyard outside which Peter is warming himself by the fire. And something that occurred to me this time through that I don't know, that, you know, we don't have enough information to be certain, but as they move Jesus from one place to another, might have been that moment when Jesus turns and looks at Peter. We can't be sure about that. But at some point during all of this, Jesus sees Peter, and Peter's out there saying, "I don't even know him. I don't know what you're talking about." And all that is added to the injustice of what's going on as Jesus is being tried by these priests, so-called. So now let's go to Mark chapter 14 to see Jesus on trial before Caiaphas. And I've heard Caiaphas and Caiaphas, so I probably said it both ways already tonight. I'm not sure which way it's supposed to be. This is the one who is the sort of acting official high priest, and this next trial also includes a larger group of the rulers among the Jews. Verse 53 says, they led Jesus to the high priest, and all the chief priests and the elders and the scribes came together. So now there's more people. Again, remember, this is in the wee hours of the morning. This is in the dead of night that these guys have gotten up, that they must have arranged all this because they wouldn't normally be there. They hatched this plan, and now they've got him, and so they're going to have this hearing. Again, the purpose of all this is, what are we going to accuse Jesus of? That's the purpose. You know, how are we going to explain that we want to kill him? We got to have something to say he did wrong. So verse 55 says, the chief priests and the whole council were seeking testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but they found none. For many bore false witness against him, but their testimony did not agree. And some stood up and bore false witness against him, saying, we heard him say, I will destroy this temple that's made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another, not made with hands. Yet even about this, their testimony did not agree. There's a few things interesting about this. First, of course, try as they might, with that whole group there, not one of them could come up with anything credible against Jesus. Which, again, should have been some kind of indication that maybe there's something really, really, really wrong with this trial, that none of us has anything we can say against him that he did that's worthy of any kind of death, and yet here we are trying to kill the man. And there's none of us who know something. Now, they had already decided in their minds that he, you know, needed to be killed, but now that they're trying to come up with a reason, they can't find one. And even false witnesses are no help. Now, I thought to myself before, if they're false witnesses, and the problem is their stories don't line up, why don't they just change their story to line up their stories, as people do even today in corrupt cases where the prosecution coaches everybody to make sure that we've got to get our story the same, right? So it was around 2 o'clock, wasn't it, when, you know, they help everybody make sure that their stories make sense, because any kind of inconsistency obviously hurts your case. So you would think, well, if they're false witnesses, if this whole thing's a charade, why didn't they do that? And then even when you look at the particular thing that they tried to use against him, that he said, I will tear down this temple and build it in 3 days, that is very similar to something he actually did say. In John, he said, destroy this temple and in 3 days I will rebuild it. And John goes on to say he was speaking of his body, but they didn't understand what he meant, you know. So he had said something like that, which makes me think they weren't, in the sense of false witnesses, they weren't just inventing stuff. I mean, if they wanted to do that, they could have just said, okay, I'm going to say that I heard him say this, or I'm going to say, but they weren't, they were trying to think of some factual thing to use against him. So what made them false witnesses then? It wasn't the information they were using, it was their motive for doing it. They were trying to take something he said, twist it around, and use it to accuse him of blasphemy. So their whole approach was, they were railroading him. Their whole search was not for truth, but to come up with something they could use. So I think that's the reason they are false witnesses. But it is interesting, they seem to be almost going through the motions of trying to come up with some actual thing he had said they could use against him. Perhaps the other reason why they do that, as opposed to just making up something, is, again, if they had to explain this to anybody else, you know, the people who love Jesus, it would really help if they had something that other people had heard him say. And they could say, you know that he said, and have something they could use against him that had been heard by people. It would add some legitimacy to what they're trying to do. So anyway, it's just an interesting thing about these false witnesses. Now, verse 60 says, the high priest stood up in the midst. He finally gets frustrated with his whole proceedings and asked Jesus, have you no answer to make? What is it these men testify against you? But he remained silent and made no answer. Again, the high priest asked him, are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? And Jesus said, I am. And you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven. And the high priest tore his garments and said, what further need of witnesses do we need? You have heard his blasphemy. What is your decision? And they all condemned him as deserving death. They understood exactly what Jesus was saying in his answer to this question. And now you can tell the high priest is just exasperated, because here they spent all this time in the middle of the night trying to come up with something, and all he had to do was ask Jesus this question, and Jesus gives him what he was looking for to begin with, which if someone was just an ordinary person, it wouldn't be right to make those kinds of statements about yourself. But what if Jesus is telling the truth? They never even seem to acknowledge that possibility, that Jesus might be actually telling the truth about this. In fact, when Peter was preaching in Acts chapter 3, he said, "Brothers, I know you acted in ignorance as did your rulers." So they did not know they were killing the Son of God. It doesn't mean that they thought they were doing the right thing, though, because this whole thing stinks of just absolute corruption. There's nothing about any of this that is legitimate. Verse 65 goes on, "And some began to spit on him and to cover his face and to strike him, saying to him, 'Prophesy.' And the guards received him with blows." So this shows just an unreal amount of hatred toward this man who they didn't even have any kind of thing they could charge him with or accuse him of. And he hasn't said or done anything to them. And they're just being hateful and cruel. Chapter 15, verse 1 says, "As soon as it was morning, the chief priests held a consultation with the elders and scribes and the whole council. And they bound Jesus and led him away and delivered him over to Pilate." The whole council would be the Sanhedrin. That's like 71 of them. And that's the Supreme Court. So during the course of the night, they'd kind of worked out their case. They've got their charges. They've got their evidence. Now they get the final thing. Now they have a consultation, and having all of that in place, they have something to charge him with, and they send him over to the Romans. Now, their big charge is that he claims to be the Son of God, and he claims to be, you know, Christ, the King of the Jews. And so that's, you know, how's that going to fly with the Romans? What is Herod going to think about that? And Pilate, we'll see next time. That's what we'll pick up with next time. So now, let's stop and make some applications of this for ourselves. And, you know, we read these things, and we're sort of like reading old trial records from old case. You know, we've dug up these records of questions and answers from a trial that's 2,000 years old, long over with. And in a way, I'm glad. I mean, aren't you glad that this part of the story is over? Because that night and the next day must have seemed like forever, if you try to imagine the slaps turn into beatings, turn into scourging, turn into hours of hanging on the cross. It must have seemed like forever, but it's over. And I'm glad for his sake that that's over, because now Jesus is seated at the right hand of God, and it's all good as far as that goes. That part, that this tragic thing is over. But in another way, it's not over. In another way, the trial continues to this very day, because one by one, people have to themselves be the jury of this and decide, what do you say about Jesus? What do you believe about Jesus? Do you believe that he was telling the truth and that he is the Christ, the Son of God? Or do you reject those claims and say that he is not? Now, there's really no middle ground. Jesus is either the Son of God or he's a phony. What's popular today is for people to say, well, I think that Jesus was a good man. He was a very wise teacher. They would kind of rank him with, you know, maybe Gandhi and all these other kind of good, you know, moral people who taught people to do what's right and tell the truth and be good. And, you know, people who are trying to be diplomatic about it would say that. Very few people would say anything bad about Jesus. I mean, there's, again, if you wanted to, what could you say? There's nothing you can say bad about Jesus. So they will try to say, well, I think that, you know, he must have been a good man, and that's as far as they're willing to go if they don't believe in him. But that doesn't really work if you look at what he said. For instance, when Jesus makes statements like this, "I am the way, the truth, and life, and no one comes to the Father except through me." Do these people who don't believe that Jesus is the Son of God accept that statement? They can't accept that. And Jesus made many other statements like that, that you can't just be on the fence about. You either believe that he is the only way to the Father, or you reject that statement as being untrue. You see what I mean? When you actually look at what Jesus taught and stood for and said and represented, you really can't straddle the fence about it. You have to decide, I believe or I don't. And so for that reason, he remains on trial in the hearts of mankind. As long as the world stands, people will be having to decide for themselves, what do you believe about Jesus? Where do you stand on this question? So how do we decide? Well, the answer is to listen to the evidence. Remember what Jesus said when he was on trial before Annas? He said, I've spoken openly to the world. I've always taught in synagogues and in the temple where the Jews come together. I said nothing in secret. Why do you ask me? Ask those who have heard me what I said to them. They know what I said. Well, where do we go to find out today some information about Jesus? We go to hear from the people who heard him teach, right? What we're reading from, these records that we have, the gospel accounts, are the eyewitness testimony of the people who sat there and heard what he said and watched his miracles, and they're willing to tell you what they saw if you're willing to listen. That's the evidence that we have. So again, we can listen to the evidence and we can decide for ourselves what are we going to say about him. And sadly, many people who